This is John Malkin, and you're listening to K-Squid, KSQD, broadcasting at 90.7, 89.7, and 89.5 FM, also on the internet at ksqd.org. The following interview was originally broadcast on March 12, 2026, on KZSC, on Transformation Highway, which airs Thursdays at noon. Today you'll hear an interview with Anna Zaros, Director of Advancement for the international organization Nonviolent Peace Force. Their mission is to protect civilians in violent conflict zones through unarmed strategies, build peace side by side with local communities, and advocate for the wider adoption of these nonviolent approaches to safeguard human lives and dignity. This work is based on Mohandas Gandhi's idea of a nonviolent peace force that would replace the violent strategies of police and militaries across the planet and instead utilize what Anna Zaros calls ancestral technologies of nonviolence that keep people safe, like de-escalation and protective presence. You'll hear Anna describe the work of nonviolent peace force in places like Sudan, the Philippines, Ukraine, and Minneapolis, where she lives and has been participating in mutual aid efforts to keep children and families safe during the last months of ICE raids there. One of Nonviolent Peace Force's main offices in the United States is located in Minneapolis. You can read a recent article by Anna Zaros at the website for the Meta Center for Nonviolence, titled The Two Hands of Nonviolence in Minneapolis. Personally, I've been following and supporting Nonviolent Peace Force since it was established in 2003, and in the past I've interviewed their former Central Asia coordinator, Rajiv Vora, and two of their founders, David Herzo and Mel Duncan. A special thanks to Gilda Betancourt for coordinating this interview. Here now is Anna Zaros. I think you're in Minneapolis, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, that's kind of, well, I want to hear about that. I mean, you've been in a place that has been receiving a lot of attention, and there's been a lot of violence there, obviously. Maybe first start with telling me, and for people who haven't heard about Nonviolent Peace Force, just describe briefly the history of the organization and the goals of Nonviolent Peace Force.
Yeah. So at Nonviolent Peace Force, our mission is to protect civilians in violent conflicts through unarmed strategies. So we work side by side with local communities to keep people safe. There's a few layers to that. I would say the first layer is directly protecting civilians. So if there's risk of violence, if there's active conflict or war, making sure people stay alive, but without the use of weapons. And then the second level is interrupting cycles of violence. So we can be reactive and directly providing protection in active situation, active violence, but we also need to interrupt those cycles of violence so there's long-term safety and protection for people. So when we use weapons to keep people safe, we're still showing the world that violence is necessary. And our experience on the ground is that when you use nonviolence to keep people safe and interrupt cycles of violence, that is more effective and long lasting. So for example, in South Sudan, there's communities that have generations of revenge killings, and it's, you know, a cycle back and forth of killing people amongst these communities. And community members came to us and said, we really want to stop this cycle. So we work with those local communities to build trust and relationships across the different communities so that eventually they can get to a place where they can sit down and create an agreement on how they're going to handle their differences without violence. There's local trusted messengers who can be going between both sides, that kind of thing. And that's just one example of how we would interrupt a cycle of violence for the long term. And then the third level, I would say, is a broader shift, a broader paradigm shift to nonviolence. Globally, we're all socialized to think we need violence to solve our problems. And if we can move the consciousness towards nonviolence, then that's even more effective and widespread impact of keeping people safe for the long term. So we work in 9 different countries around the world. The specifics of that, and we can get into it, look really different depending on the place because we work so in tandem with what communities are asking for. We were founded in 2002 by 3 peace activists, David Hartso, Mel Duncan, and Mary Lou Ott. And there was a convening event in India attended by peace advocates from 49 countries who officially founded NP. And by a year later in the fall of 2003, we had our first program in Sri Lanka. And we're founded on Gandhi's idea of the Shanti Sena, which translates to peace force. He proposed this in 1938, and his vision was this global nonviolent brigade of trained people who could be mobilized in place of traditional police and military to resolve conflicts and keep harmony in communities. So we were founded on that vision and then over time became this international non-government organization with official programs in different countries, but really rooted in this vision of a peace force.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. Before we get more into details around the world and what Nonviolent Peace Force has been doing, just tell me a little bit about yourself, your role at NP, and how you came into the world of nonviolent activism.
Yeah, so I'm the director of advancement, and I'm based out of our office in Minneapolis in Minnesota. And my role is really focused on what I like to think about a lot is that third layer of the paradigm shift, finding folks, engaging with folks who want to support the work of Nonviolent Peace Force, and also amplifying the messages that nonviolence works, that this is what it looks like in different places, so that we can be moving towards more people involved in this work of Nonviolent Peace Force. I like to say I was first radicalized for peace. I was in high school when the attacks happened on September 11th. And then I lived in a community that has a pretty strong military connection. And so I had people very close to me in my family, in my friend groups, who chose to join the military because of what happened during the attacks on 9/11. And were deployed abroad in Iraq a few years later. And I saw what changes happened to them, how they were impacted by being in the military and trained to kill other people. And at the same time, I am listening to bombs drop and the stories of communities in Iraq and Afghanistan and hearing of the damage that's happening to those communities. And just none of it made sense to me. None of it seemed like it was achieving any goal that was helpful, was certainly not the way to solve our problems. And it just felt like harm on all sides. And then I grew up in pretty strong Catholic social justice tradition. And so there's a really strong tradition of nonviolence and peace. And certainly I'm not a practicing Catholic now, but if I have any faith or religion, it's certainly in the historical Jesus as a really radical, nonviolent, anti-capitalist, anti-authoritarian person. And so so that's really how I came to nonviolence in this work. And it's interesting because I think folks oftentimes, I've experienced, and I think lots of folks have, that nonviolence seems like this idea that just is so pie in the sky, like nice, but not realistic. Except using violence to solve our problems is also just a theory. Like, it's never been proven to work either. And so, there's actually tons of social science research about how nonviolence is more effective. And so at this point, I just, like, how could I not be you know, a believer of nonviolence and try to practice that in my daily life. And of course, the daily practice of nonviolence is deeply difficult, but that's why it's a practice. So, yeah.
I love hearing that you grew up Catholic and that you do find some power in recognizing Jesus as a nonviolent, anti-capitalist, anti-military presence and model. You know, I mentioned to you that I've written these books on punk rock, and there's actually a whole realm of Christian punk, but I basically have not found any Christian punks who sing about Jesus in that way as a powerful, radical, anti-capitalist figure. Most Christian punk is evangelical. I've been really, in my adult life, inspired by the Catholic workers who practice that type of Jesus direct action to obstruct violence around the world and not participate in war, and then help people who are hungry and need somewhere to sleep. They're doing this whole thing. You're also reminding me of Erica Chenoweth and her book that was sort of the first book that took scientific data and examined how well does violence work in changing things, making a culture more democratic and making it last compared to nonviolent. And it's hugely more successful using nonviolence. I think I want to ask you for, you know, you can spend as much time as you want on this, but what's happening presently? And then talk about nonviolent peace force around the world and successes and different strategies in different places. But it's tough not to think about what's happening right now. And it's crazy because I could have said that 6 months ago and 6 months before that and back the last 50 years. My son is 18, and last night he's saying, oh, in class we're talking about how people my age might have to go into the military and go fight somewhere, maybe soon, maybe not. Tell me your own thinking about what's happening now with the U.S. bombing Iran, Israel bombing Iran and Lebanon, Iran is bombing Dubai, Gaza is continuing to be attacked. That whole area is hugely inflamed the last week. And if there is a perspective from Nonviolent Peace Force on what's happening.
Yeah, for sure. So we do have teams in the region. We have staff in the region. And so what we've been focused on immediately is making sure people stay safe. You know, we've had to do evacuations. Our work in Iraq, for example, is focused on helping. We're in northern Iraq. Actually, our offices are in Erbil, which is very close to the military base that's being attacked. There's a U.S. military base there, and our team has had to evacuate to safer locations. And it sets us back. It sets back the work of our focus there has been helping communities who have these intercommunal tensions. So particularly 8 years ago when, maybe a little bit longer than that now, when ISIS was defeated in Iraq, there are just these deep lasting tensions among ethnic groups where we are in northern Iraq. And before that, even, you know, there's the multiple invasions of the US and all that. And then, of course, this what's happening now is just another iteration of that. And so we were doing things like helping people who had been associated in some way with ISIS, women and children who had been associated in some way whether directly or not, even if it's just a community perception of their association, you know, they had been, had to flee their communities. They're now trying to come back to their homes and face a lot of harassment and anger directed at them. So helping to mediate those returns so they would happen peacefully and people could be reintegrated back into their community, helping different communities, Sunni and Shia, and other communities have togetherness. So we talk about it technically as social cohesion, but helping, you know, it might look like a soccer tournament, right? But it's a soccer tournament in a part of town where different community groups don't come together. And so we build the trust and relationships to help people show up at the soccer tournament and actually engage with someone they would never engage with on a daily basis. And then that continues to root more trust and more relationship and help to build long-term peace among communities. So that kind of work is, can happen right now and is certainly pushed backwards because of geopolitics. We also are, in any type of crisis, our call is always to center the protection of civilians. When we have these dramatic escalations like this, or even just local conflicts, right, the people who are most harmed are the everyday people who are just trying to live their lives. Our head of mission in Iraq, Tiago, said, you know, people have lost their sense of safety. They're worried where to sleep. They're worried if they can send their kid to school. So we are a nonpartisan organization. We don't name names. We don't come out and talk about a particular issue or who's wrong or who's right in terms of who's bombing who. We can't keep people safe and work in local communities if we're seen as being party to one part of the conflict or another. But our executive director, Tiffany, likes to say we're nonpartisan in all things except violence. We are always going to call for an end to violence no matter what. And we are always going to say that and call on the actors involved to center the protection of civilians. You know, we have already seen the numbers of civilians that have been killed in the last 5 days. And it's completely unacceptable. And so, yeah, we've been calling on international actors to center the protection of civilians.
I think people would be interested to hear about strategies that Nonviolent Peace Force uses and other groups use in situations where there is violence happening in the moment. When people are shooting at each other or harming each other, in what ways does NP interact in communities when that's happening? I know there's specific practices like unarmed civilian protection and unarmed accompaniment, accompanying people who have been threatened because they are activists or journalists, things like that. In kind of the front lines of violence, how is Nonviolent Peace Force present?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the most important thing I want to name is that no matter what the violent conflict situation is, there's always space for peace. And I think that that's very easy to think that's not possible. So for example, when we went into Ukraine for the first time, it was maybe about, it was about 4 months after the full-scale invasion of Russia and Ukraine. And our first reaction was there's being bombs and shelling every day. Like, what can unarmed civilian protection even do in that situation? Our first reaction was, I don't know if we can operate in this kind of, you know, full-scale war type of landscape. A lot of our work had been much more locally based intercommunal violence. And so an international war felt different. Our teams did go in to do an assessment and found that there is still space. And so, for example, in Ukraine, our work has looked a lot like protecting the frontline protectors. So local, we went in to do this assessment and found that there was this whole network of local Ukrainians. It was fishing associations and women's groups who mobilized to keep people safe or to distribute aid where people, when people, like, aid was being dropped in central city locations and people who had mobility issues or were in far-flung reaches of that province couldn't get aid. Just local Ukrainians were jumping in their car, driving to the front line, finding families who need to be evacuated and driving them back out. So in that situation, our role was to support, and still is to support them. And that has really, you know, at first they needed helmets and flak jackets to stay safe. They also needed shelters or safe houses where people could go to after they've been evacuated. Now we've created a whole, what we call a duty of care package, where local Ukrainians can have life insurance, they can get psychosocial support. And then there's technical pieces too, right? The shellings have really transitioned quite a bit into more the use of drones. And we're seeing this in the Middle East now too. And the drones don't get detected in the same way that, in missile defense systems, they fly literally under the radar. So then we started helping local Ukrainians use frequency analyzers. So a frequency analyzer can pick up the signal of the drone, and then someone is able to have a few extra split seconds to race their car to 90 miles an hour to get out of range of that drone, right? So they're... This just in one country program is a wide array of ways that we can keep people safe when there's active violence. I would also say that one place where we've worked and some stories that comes to mind too is the Philippines. We've been in the Philippines in the southern region, Mindanao, since 2007. Now there's a peace agreement, but there wasn't when we were there, when we first started being there. When we, in the early days of our work there, there was a ceasefire agreement, but there were still active skirmishes and violence. But because we had really deep, trusted relationships in the community, and we were official nonpartisan observer of the peace agreement or of the ceasefire agreement, we were able to directly intervene when either a skirmish had happened and we could create humanitarian corridors to get civilians out when there was firefighting happen, or stop it before it even started. So one of my coworkers, Daphne, has this great story. She told me about how they would bring the leaders of the armed forces of the Philippines and the group they were fighting, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, to meetings in their office. And someone would always have to stay outside in the van with all their guns because they couldn't bring their guns in. And our two staff who led these meetings were both women, because it was a strategic choice. They were less threatening and they could sort of calm everyone down in a way that like another man in the room couldn't. And the community trusted our staff so much, our staff are of the community there, that, you know, they would call us and say, we see the armed forces of the Philippines moving on one side of our village, and we see the Moro Islamic Liberation Front moving on another side of the village. There are these local units moving closer and we're all getting really scared. And in real time, sometimes our staff in that office would then turn to the leaders of these armed groups and say, you guys need to call these units back. And we would be, and they would do that, and they would be responsive because we had again built the trust and the relationship. So there is always room for keeping people safe or actively de-escalating conflicts.
This is John Malkin, and you're listening to KSQD, KSQD, broadcasting at 90.7, 89.7, and 89.5 FM, also on the internet at ksqd.org. You're listening to an interview with Anna Zaros, Director of Advancement for the international organization Nonviolent Peace Force. Here again is Anna Zaros. I like you reminding me that there's always some room, even in what looks like the most squashed, violent episode happening. You mentioned earlier some of the founders of Nonviolent Peace Force, David Herzog, Mel Duncan, and I interviewed both of those guys, and Rajiv Vora was in Santa Cruz many years ago, and I did a lovely interview with him. And at that time, and still in a lot of ways, police accountability became a focus for me. I saw someone killed by Santa Cruz police when I first moved here, and I was a community studies student at the university, And I worked with a group that was creating a police review board for the city. I was later appointed to sit on that board. I later resigned from that board because it was meeting the needs of the police and not the community as we had designed it. I came out of that experience thinking we need to disengage from the police and create new systems of safety. So that was around 1997 when I thought that. And when all these people have been killed by the police, and including George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others, and a few years ago, hearing people around the world saying, we need to defund or abolish or create something new, that was really exciting for me. I'd never heard so many people saying that. And you've mentioned that including ending military violence, a goal of nonviolent peace forces, ending police violence and creating new systems in all these realms where we ask people to come with guns into our homes to solve our problems. That seems absurd. They usually raise the level of violence rather than diminish it, or they threaten to raise the level of violence. Anna, you live in Minneapolis, and there's been a lot of violence there recently with ICE doing raids, kidnapping immigrants, killing activists, Renee Good and Alex Preddy. And I think the Nonviolent Peace Force main office in the U.S. is in Minneapolis.
Yeah, one of our offices. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. And you wrote a beautiful piece for Meta Center for Nonviolence that's online, and it's called The Two Hands of Nonviolence in Minneapolis. And you're talking about dealing with the violence that's happening there and the ICE raids. And one of your kids asks you, what does abolish mean, Mama? And what a question. And you're describing how parents there, like yourself, are forming patrols around the schools to make sure that ICE doesn't come onto the school grounds. You also are writing that as a practitioner of nonviolence, as hard as this moment is, it is also deeply inspiring, and that you're building on years and decades of powerful local organizing. Tell me what that has been like, being in Minneapolis and being present for what's happening, and also bringing your ideas and actions from Nonviolent Peace Force into what's happening in Minneapolis.
Yeah, I'm a little like, where do I even start? But I'm going to start on the morning that Renee Good was murdered. The ICE surge here in Minneapolis started in mid-December. It started hitting the news about in January, but it started in mid-December. So, you know, my family and lots of other families at my kids' school is situated just a few blocks from where Renee was murdered. And so for weeks already, we had been driving kids to school. At one point, the parents were collectively driving 20% of kids to school. So that morning, actually at like 7 a.m., we had already been hearing of a lot of ICE activity just right around the school. And so we have our signal chats to communicate all that. And when I pulled up to the school, it was actually we had been driving kids for a long time, but this was the first morning where there was a whole ring of parents and community members just around the entire perimeter of the school. And it was beautiful. It's incredible to see that many people show up. And also I was crying. I was like, why do we have to create a safety perimeter around our school? Right. This shouldn't be the world that we live in. And then we have it is literally a caravan of minivans lined up with, you know, mostly white moms you know, holding the hands of like a gaggle of like 5 to 10 little kids, making sure they get to school. And so it's been deeply beautiful to be in community in this way. But that morning you could feel the tensions rising. And I actually sent a message to our executive director, who's my boss. And I said, it's going to get way worse here. The violence is going to escalate and I might not be at work. And just 10 minutes after that, the news of Renee's shooting had broken. So, I mean, I think that there's so much I could say about this. I feel grateful to be in a place where we had such a legacy of organizing, and it goes back to George Floyd, but it goes back even farther than that to Winston Smith's killing, Philando Castile, Jamar Clark. You know, there's a huge Black Lives Matter movement in the Twin Cities, and they have very strongly shown up around ICE out work. Before that, it is the American Indian movement in the 60s. Before that, it's a really strong labor movement. I think anyone who, I'm a transplant to Minnesota, and one of the first things you are oriented to is Paul Wellstone's, who was a very beloved politician in Minnesota. And he has a famous quote, "We all do better when we all do better." And that is a mantra you learn and are oriented to when you get here. And I think for me, seeing there is just so much damage, and that damage is going to last for a very long time. And ICE is still here. You know, they're announcing that there is the surge is over, but basically they've moved out of Minneapolis and are now targeting more rural and suburban communities. And the damage will be lasting. There, you know, we talked to the teachers about the learning loss of kids who couldn't come to school for those few months, for example. The economic impact is going to take a very long time to heal from. And we also gained the knowledge that we are here for each other. It was very much one of the people that I have learned a lot of unarmed civilian protection work from, and who has taught me the tactics of de-escalation and that sort of thing, and situational awareness. He would say, no one's coming to save us but us. And that, I very deeply lived that in Minneapolis. Like, even our local government didn't move fast enough or didn't help at all or actively were engaged with ICE. And it was only the community that was showing up for ourselves. I would say that, you know, Nonviolent Peace Force we did have a program, direct program work in Minneapolis doing unarmed civilian protection, and that funding was cut under this current presidential administration. And so that it actually had to sunset at the end of 25, right when ICE was here. So a lot of us here who are still here as Nonviolent Peace Force staff operate in our personal capacity. You know, for me, for example, the parents outside of my kids' school, you know, I wanted them to have some tools of de-escalation so that we all felt like we had the same level of trust and understanding with each other of how we could contribute to keeping the temperature down if and when I showed up. And then I would say, you know, we still have teams working in San Diego and New York, and they've been doing this work too for a long time. And so our staff in San Diego, for example, came here and did some training support, protection safety support. So we've been able, even if we don't physically have a big presence in Minneapolis anymore as an organization, been able to support this national capacity building around, you know, knowing our rights with ICE, preparing to de-escalate when we need to.
Thank you. I'm sorry that you and other people in Minneapolis and other places are having to deal with that. I don't know if you want to say anything more about, did you have direct confrontations with any ICE agents? Were you able to minimize something that looked like it was going to get worse, or did you practice witnessing what was happening to with the goal of minimizing violence at a certain confrontation with ICE?
Yeah. So for me personally, one of the asks very early on by our local organizers was pick a lane. So either do mutual aid or do legal observation work. And because I was driving kids to school. I was in the mutual aid lane. And the reason why that happened was because very early on, I started tracking who was following them around. So it was not safe to bring groceries to family or drive our neighbors around if they had our license plate from observing them. That meant we were going to put people at risk. So I personally avoided ICE as much as possible. You know, when I would track in the signal chats where they were, when they were nearby. At one time I was like, oh, I'm so close. I'm going to go drive with my van and observe. And I was like, oh, wait, I'm in my van. I cannot go observe right now. So because it was a tactic for keeping people safe. It's interesting. One time I was driving, doing my school runs, and we were on a main thoroughfare with, it's sort of the immigrant business corridor. And ICE was there and I had kids in my car and they were like, is that ICE? And so I said, yes. And we all had to do some breathing exercises. At one point my kids, there are whistles and baskets for free at every business around town. And at one point my kids picked up a whistle and one of them started wearing it. And I'm like, and we had to have a conversation. I said, you know, I'm glad you're wearing this whistle. Do you know when to use it? Right. So I said, you do not use it unless you see ICE. And she's like, nope, I understand. She's 7. Okay. And then I said, okay, so what does ICE look like? Can you tell me? And she said, well, usually they're in all black, their faces are covered, or sometimes they're wearing the stuff that looks like when you go hunting. And I'm like, okay, my 7-year-old child knows exactly how to identify ICE. Like, I'm both proud of her and think this is horrifying. So that's kind of the way I personally moved through the space. I did marshal for our biggest ICE out protest. And that was a beautifully peaceful space. And there wasn't, you know, we had to de-escalate. Some people were kind of like getting a little riled up. There were some folks, there were a whole line of cars parked who couldn't get through because the protest took forever because it was huge. And some folks were getting them like riled up around to like honk their horns and rev their engines to show support. But cars are the biggest risks in protest settings. And so folks who didn't understand what was happening or see it were just walking through were getting really, really scared. And so we de-escalated that situation. That's been a lot of the work we've done at Nonviolent Peace Force in the US, is keeping civic actions and spaces safe. And luckily I think Minnesotans, again, are well-trained on how to do that themselves. So it didn't take too much effort, but yeah.
Thank you, Anna. On the Nonviolent Peace Force website, there's a small section talking about violence in the United States, and that violence has been baked into the DNA of the United States since its inception, from the enslavement of Africans to the genocide of Native Americans to the exploitation of communities of color. And this is our history, and this is sort of the history of the world and how people have conquered other people. One step further back from that, I think a common belief among human beings is that violence is part of our DNA and inherent to communications between people. And that this idea of nonviolence is impossible. You mentioned that earlier. People have that view. Then, you know, on the left politically, and even just in day-to-day life, the realm of self-defense, for example, a woman who's being physically harmed by her partner or some family member and defends herself physically, or a group of people who are being harmed by the United States, who has bombed their village in El Salvador in 1980, and those people getting weapons and defending themselves. What about these realms of violence and nonviolence? What's your perspective on those beliefs?
Yeah, that's a big question. And it makes me think about what you were bringing up earlier around defund police too, that for me personally, this, again, Nonviolent Peace Force is a nonpartisan organization, so we don't take particular political stances. But for me personally, when we're navigating this violence or nonviolence, and, you know, really tricky situations. I used to work at a domestic violence agency, and I think domestic violence is the hardest. If we're trying to navigate anything in the land of nonviolence, I think domestic violence is one of the hardest spaces to do that. And so complicated. And so, our deep family relationships is very, very, very complicated and hard to navigate. But I would say, you know, for me, the way I try to navigate this is having an abolitionist worldview for me personally. And I think, again, personally, unarmed civilian protection, the work we do at Nonviolent Peace Force, is abolitionist. So not everyone would agree with me on that per se, but that's what I think. And I think that a pushback to an abolitionist worldview that I've heard is, oh, you just want to tear things down. Like, you just want to defund police, or you just want to abolish ICE. And like, well, what would we do then? When, if you read abolitionists, if you read Ruth Wilson Gilmore, if you read Miriam Kaba, it's about building something. It's not about taking it down. And sure, there are things we want to end. We want to end the violence, but we end the violence by building systems and communities and cultures rooted in transformative justice, in restoration, in accountability. You know, our violent systems now actually do not hold anyone accountable in any way that is restorative or reparative to a relationship, to a break. So I think that we need to stand more firm in that. After George Floyd was murdered, I remember most of our city council standing on a platform that said defund police written along the bottom. And then it just kind of fizzled away because they hit roadblock after roadblock. And it was a political moment that people felt inspired by, but they actually hadn't done the work, in my opinion, of what that worldview, what it actually takes to get to that worldview, right? When we're focused on abolitionism is a political point to score rather than a complete worldview and culture change, then we're not going to win, right? We win when we really stand firm and know we don't have to live this way. And there are better ways to do this. And it is about creating something that fully repairs from harm. So yeah, I mean, and I think you could take any kind of conflict situation in our communities and in our cultures and kind of break it apart with an abolitionist worldview in terms of how you would actually specifically address it. And Miriam Kaba actually has like a great essay where she envisions a abolitionist community and that someone murders someone else. And then what practically is actually done. And that person is held accountable. So we can do that, and we need to stand firm in that. That is real possibility in our world if we stick to it.
I think so too. And it's just better to aim towards that anyway. You mentioned something earlier about Nonviolent Peace Force in a particular conflict zone. It might have been the Philippines, where a woman doing the conflict resolution was just going to work better than a man in the room. And it's so interesting. We live in a world that is based on reward and punishment, and that has been designed by men. And there are lots of practices from the past that women were spearheading that have been diminished in how we hold them. I think even part of the United States and part of Russia, actually, communism and capitalism were created partly on what people saw Native American people doing. But both of those systems left out a huge part of the way things worked in a democracy, and that was the role of women. So I'm curious to hear a little more about that. And you call it in your essay that you wrote, ancestral technologies. You're not pointing to women in your article. I am. but you write that, through my work at Nonviolent Peace Force, I've learned from Global South communities effective practices for keeping people safe, like de-escalation and protective presence. I mean, one thing important about this is to say, oh, look here how it worked before. Let's try that now. So tell me about the role of women, if you want, in ancestral technologies of nonviolence.
Yeah. And we talk about ancestral technologies because it is something we believe it is something so innate to us, right? Even here in Minneapolis, no one asked someone to go give another family member a ride or to create mutual aid networks, right? There was no permission given. We just, this is what we are naturally going to do. We're naturally going to stand up for people when unarmed civilian protection feels like this maybe technical or too hard to grasp concept. I ask people to think about, remember when you walked your friend home at night because it was safer for the two of you to walk together? That's unarmed civilian protection. And across our country programs, we see the role of women so powerfully. In South Sudan in particular, we have women's protection teams. And they are, you know, women, I think, have this unique experience because of how we're socialized and because of how we're situated in community, that oftentimes women have access that men don't in conflict settings. In the Philippines, for example, there was this group called the Bangsamoro Indigenous Women's Auxiliary Brigade. And these were women who during the conflict were wives and family members of the Moral Islamic Liberation Front. And the women would be the ones who would go to the bridge and set the bomb, for example, so that the armed forces of the Philippines couldn't cross the bridge into a community. And they could do that because they fly under the radar and they can have access in ways that men can't in conflict settings because they're viewed as someone who is more of a risk or more of a threat. So that Bangsamoro Indigenous Women's Auxiliary Brigade is now working in their community. They are, you know, de-weaponized, right? And they are now creating education initiatives in their community and setting up micro enterprise groups because they have the network of the families and the communities and can, you know, that gave them access before and that gives them to in a violent situation. And now when they've decided to turn over and be a peace institution in their community, they can flip that access on its head for nonviolence. So, and in South Sudan, we see things like, you know, when women individually would go out to collect firewood, they had really high risks of assault. But then, you know, we've worked in local communities to help the women organize together around, well, why don't you move together to collect firewood? And we'll communicate with the armed groups when you're moving through to leave you alone. And we'll accompany you if you need us to. But eventually those women became leaders in their community. They became identified. They would teach other people about women's rights and sexual and gender-based violence to reduce those risks over time. So it started with just collecting firewood together and then has eventually evolved to having real stance in their communities. And some of them have been elected to local councils and things like that too. So, and there's a, I'm not going to remember her name, but there is a sociologist who did research about how in traumatic situations, you know, we have fight, flight, or freeze response, but she had done some research that women had the response of together. And so, you know, when trauma can trigger our brain to make us shut down or be antagonistic towards someone else, women have often been socialized in a way that says, no, let's bring you in. And so those are skills and experiences that are hugely valuable when we're trying to build nonviolent and abolitionist communities.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you want to make sure to mention? And of course, I want you to let people know how to stay in touch with Nonviolent Peace Force and how to support NP. I want to throw in one more question too. As we're talking, I'm remembering how important nonviolent communication has been to me, the specific technique taught by Marshall Rosenberg. It's such a powerful method day to day, but it was designed to be used even in armed conflict situations and dealing with that and de-escalating. And Marshall and this other guy, Dominique Barter, who's been in Brazil, sitting down with people whose, you know, this family's son was killed by this family's son, and they are going to talk without a goal of punishment or even a certain outcome of that conversation. I think unraveling the whole idea of behaviorism, we change people's behavior by hurting them. And if they've done something very bad, we hurt them very bad for a very long time, put them in a cage and torture them, and then their behavior changes. I don't know if you want to say something about that realm, and then if we didn't cover something that you want to cover.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and I know a lot of my colleagues around the world love nonviolent communication, use it in their daily lives. And I think that is a skill that maybe in some ways naturally comes to people as they do this work, as they're standing up in their communities, talking to someone who is causing violence in their community and asking them to consider a different alternative. And so, you know, one thing that I wrote about in the article you mentioned was the Barbara Deming's Two Hands of Nonviolence. And that is the ethic with which we do all of our work at Nonviolent Peace Force of, you know, we're going to be clear that we want you to stop the violence, but we are always going to invite you into relationship. And I think nonviolent communication can give us those tools to have the right language for that, because it can be really, really hard to invite someone into a relationship who's causing direct harm in your community. I wrote the article I did because I could recognize that in my own self, that the anger felt towards ICE agents was something that I needed to process, right? That I know that deep down we're not getting out of this if we stop at "you're a horrible human being for doing this in my community, get out," right? Yes, we need to stop that violent actions. Like, we still need to see the humanity in that person and invite them into a different way of being. So, yeah, I would say, you know, if folks are interested in learning more about Nonviolent Peace Force, they can go to our website, nonviolentpeaceforce.org, and especially see some of the work we're doing in the United States. We just put out some really great stories about the communities we work with and how, especially in New York and San Diego, and how they're experiencing increases in violence, whether that's violence directed at them or threats directed at them because of their identity, or, you know, an overreach of state violence, an escalation of use of violence by state actors, and how we've been adapting to support them in these times and doing a lot of role plays so people can embody what it would feel like if they're faced with that threat. And really, that's something I talked about a lot to my communities in Minneapolis of, you know, it takes a lot of work to do nonviolence. And the more we can kind of flex that muscle and make it stronger when hopefully it never happens, but when that situation does come.
Thank you for a very rich and deep conversation about nonviolence and the work that Nonviolent Peace Force is doing. I love Nonviolent Peace Force, and I really deeply appreciate that it's a presence and it brought to life this idea that Gandhi had. And I was really happy when I encountered that in his writings, this idea that of obstruction and construction, which you were talking about earlier. We need to obstruct injustice, but maybe spend even a little more energy on constructing the communities that we want to be present in. And we need to do both. And you're doing that. And I really appreciate your energy and your time doing that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
This is John Malkin, and you're listening to KSQD, KSQD, broadcasting at 90.7, 89.7, and 89.5 FM, also on the internet at ksqd.org. You've been listening to an interview with Anna Zaros, Director of Advancement for Nonviolent Peace Force. For more information, go to nonviolentpeaceforce.org. You can also read a recent article by Anna Zaros titled "The Two Hands of Nonviolence in Minneapolis." You can find that at the website for the Meta Center for Nonviolence.